For almost a generation, there has been a wall between the People's Republic of China and the United States of America. In these past 4 days, we have begun the long process of removing that wall between us.
The relationship between the United States and China will shape the 21st century, which makes it as important as any bilateral relationship in the world.
I'm Mark Levitt, and welcome to Action Speaks Underappreciated Dates That Changed America, produced by AS220 and the Rhode Island Council for the Humanities. We're taping from the cafe at AS220 in Down City, Providence, Rhode Island, home of Triple Decker's Artisan Lofts and the confluence of the not-quite-so-mighty Winnisquituckett and Providence Rivers. And today, we're talking about President Nixon's 1972 visit to China and how a relationship, solidified by many banquet toasts of Mao Tai, restarted a political and economic relationship that today carries, more than any other international alliance, the future of the world in its finally balanced hands. How did President Nixon's trip help to set this new relationship in motion? And how does this relationship, born from mutual political and economic needs, now affect the future of the global economy and indeed the health of the entire world? With me today to help us figure out the answers to those and many other questions are our panelists, Howard W. French, an associate professor at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, a former reporter for the New York Times. French has served as bureau chief for Central America and the Caribbean, West Africa, Japan and the Koreas, and China in Shanghai. French is also an author, documentary photographer, and two-time nominee for the Pulitzer Prize. Dr. Robert George Lee, an associate professor of American civilization and the chair of the Department of American Civilization at Brown University, where he teaches such courses as China in the American Imagination. He has published on a wide range of subjects related to Asian American studies, racial formations, and the relationship between Asians and Americans. Three of Lee's well-known books are Dear Mie, Letters Home from Japan, 1939 to 1946, Orientals, Asian Americans in Popular Culture and Displacements and Diasporas, Asians in the Americas. Dr. William H. Overholt, a senior research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. He formerly held the Asian Policies Research Chair at Rand Center for Asian Pacific Policy and served as the director of the center. A well-known and well-respected analyst of Asian politics, Overholt is the founder of the prestigious journal Global Assessment and a frequent publisher. His recent work includes America and Asia, The Coming Transformation of Asian Geopolitics, and the award-winning The Rise of China. And Dr. Crystal Zhang, an associate assistant professor of management at Bryant University's Business College. She received her doctorate at Temple University, majoring in international business, where she studied the dynamic evolution of Chinese firms and the role that corporations and government play together. Her research work appears in the Oxford Handbook of International Business, the Journal of World Business, Asia Pacific Journal of Management, and other magazines and periodicals. We welcome all of you out here in our audience here at AS220. We welcome you, our panelists, to come and unravel this quagmire of relationships begun in some ways back in 1972. If we would take a trip back to China in 1972 when Dr. Kissinger, President Nixon, went there in that famous meeting with Chairman Mao and Zhou Enlai, what kind of China would we see then and how would it compare to the China of now? William Overholt, what do you think?
That China was a totalitarian China. It was a gray-blue China. Everybody wore the same blue-gray clothes. Haircuts were dictated. Who you married was dictated. Where you worked was dictated. And you had to go to political class several times a week and not just supply the right answers that you'd been given, but open your thoughts, and they'd better be correct thoughts. Today, all those things have obviously changed in the most dramatic ways. The other thing is it was an incredibly poor China, China where tens of millions of people had starved. And China's still a poor country, but nobody starves, and General Motors is kept alive by its sales to Chinese customers today. So very, very different.
Howard French, what does it look like today? I know all of our panelists here have been to China, and I have to say, including myself. And it was quite a scene when I went to Shanghai the first time. I think it was Lincoln Steffens, the writer, who once said, "I see the future," when he went to Russia, and it works. Well, I went to China, and it felt like the future, and I don't know whether it works or not. But it certainly felt much more like the future than the New York City that I came back to in the taxi cab after getting off of the airplane. Could someone describe, say, contemporary China, so that people out in the audience have a sense of what we're talking about? If you haven't been to China, I think it's hard to imagine.
To describe what China is like today, to be truthful, requires some nuance. You have a number of very, very impressive urban centers that have sprouted up around the country, Shanghai being the most obvious and most prominent showcase. These are places that to visit them, I mean, even many medium, what for China are medium-sized cities, have experienced extraordinary development. You see these downtown areas that have Los Angeles-style freeways and glistening new airports and beautiful shopping centers and all the rest. But there are several other Chinas, and these other Chinas, somewhat less visible Chinas, are the Chinas of, let's say, I'm going to go out on a limb here with giving a number, and I'm not sure of the number, but it's something like 600 million or 700 million peasants. These are people whose standards of living have generally improved substantially over the last generation, but who nonetheless have seen a huge gulf open up in terms of just the gap in standards of living, and it's a gulf that yawns and is growing still today. Then you have far western China, which is not just relatively undeveloped compared to particularly to the boom towns of the east, but also is ethnically a much more diverse part of China. These Chinas have problems that are all of their own as well. So it's really misleading to speak of China as, let's say, it's very difficult to speak of China in one quick, summary, neat fashion.
Crystal Zhang.
I think if you look at what happened since 1972 is that in the 70s, it's not allowed to talk about making money. Now making money is glorious. So this is one of the fascinating facts of China today is people are proud of making money, proud of establishing private-owned enterprises, and not really proud about being state-owned employees when people don't move around for decades. Like my mom worked for one company for 32 years. So this is what happened to China. People are embracing globalization. They're embracing anything that's modern, that's contemporary, that's economically making sense. So that's why you could have Starbucks coffee in Beijing or in Shanghai, or you can have Subway sandwich, and you can wear Armani and having Louis Vuitton handbag. So this is what happened in China nowadays compared to the 72s.
When President Nixon and Secretary, actually wasn't at the time Secretary Kissinger, National Security Advisor, went to China, Robert Lee, they couldn't have imagined, could they have, what this trip would bring about or at least help initiate? What do you think they were thinking of, and how did this transformation from a country that believed in the collective entity of its country begin to formulate a policy of encouraging commercialism and individualism, or did they?
I don't think actually those particular actors would have imagined necessarily what we see in China today. Because that wasn't exactly what they were interested in doing in negotiating with China, a series of understandings, understandings about how to deal with the Soviet Union, understandings about how to deal with the problem of Vietnam, and so forth. So there were very specific, I think, policy issues that needed to be resolved between these two states. So on the other hand, I do think that, you know, since the very beginnings of America, right, since the colonial moment, we've had, America has had a kind of fascination with China, a kind of special relationship, imaginary relationship, that China might be the market that if every Chinaman were to add a you know, a couple of inches to their shirts, that the mills of New England would run forever, right? So there are those, there is that, or that there are a billion souls to be saved. So there, it, America has had a very strong imaginary relationship with China. China has either been the savior of American capitalism or the devil that is going to import Chinese workers to undermine American labor.
Well, President Nixon, on his trip, said the United States must take care to build a good relationship with China as it develops. Otherwise, we will one day be confronted with the most formidable enemy that has ever existed in the history of the world. So we're going back and forth here between sort of a paranoia of what China could become with its 800 million or 1 billion people, and a real geopolitical economic necessity at the time that was dictated by what issues in 1972? What was going on? What was the context for this relationship building that happened then?
The context, the most immediate context for was, I think the biggest issue for both countries was the Soviet Union. Both countries were fixated. The United States was locked in a Cold War with the Soviet Union, and China had just fought a border war with the Soviet Union that is not terribly well known in this country, but was quite a very big deal and could have, in fact, led very conceivably to nuclear exchange between the two countries. The next immediate issue was for the United States. This was a big issue for China, too, as well, but especially for the United States was Vietnam. The United States hoped that by altering this sort of variable geometry of the powers, the two superpowers and China, that that China could somehow be of assistance in helping the United States extricate itself or prevail in Vietnam. You know, I think of this moment in diplomacy as being a sort of supreme lesson in the law of unintended consequences, a real lesson just in the sort of the nature of complexity in international affairs. You asked if Mao or Zhou Enlai could have imagined the way that China would have turned out. I think not only could they not have imagined it, but certainly Mao and perhaps Zhou Enlai as well would have been horrified, at least in terms of the sort of ideological and economic events that unfolded from the unleashing of change that resulted from this diplomacy, at least in part resulted from this diplomacy. The United States, you read that nice quote from Nixon about this most formidable enemy that, you know, one could imagine if we don't take care of our relationship with China. Well, thankfully, most people in this country, I don't think of China as our enemy, but many people think of China as this formidable competitor of the United States. And I don't think that at the moment of this, the inception of this diplomatic breakthrough, I don't think Nixon or Kissinger saw in a few decades hence China would be our most formidable economic rival in the world. I mean, I don't think that either one of them could have remotely conceived of this.
So they had mutual geopolitical interests in containing the Soviet Union. The United States had an interest in getting China to help them resolve the problem in Southeast Asia. And yet there are all these fears, both historical and time and site-specific. Crystal Zhang, you grew up in China, am I correct?
Right.
And when you were in China, what was the view of the United States? By the time you're a much younger person than I am.
Okay.
So, okay, thank you. You're supposed to say, no, I'm not. You're. But how did the view of the United States evolve from that moment in 1972 until now?
I think as a Chinese, we look at Nixon's visit, you see this as the recognition of China to the world. So this is a big thing for Chinese. As U.S. is visiting China, this is ice-breaking. But again, you look at 70s, the views as dramatically differ from views of today, because today we look at U.S. as a strategic economic partner. In the past, it's probably enemies, rivals, it's all the uncertainties, all the worries, all the suspicions that I think based on what I recall.
What was their relationship like? What was Mao like and Zhou Enlai, Bob Lee? Not that you knew them. You're too young to have known them too well yourself. But who were they? And what
You're
was it
generous.
Like when Henry Kissinger, who's an emigre from and flee Nazi Germany, and President Nixon, who is the son of grocers in California, meets these huge world figures, both of them, one very different from the other. What was it like when they met, and what are they like?
Well, you know, I think, again, it's a matter of kind of the way in which the United States, Americans tend to have these almost schizophrenic images of China and the Chinese. So that Mao, for people on the left in the 1970s, was, you know, he was the hero of the revolution. He was in some ways, you know, kind of the helmsman of where the world's proletariat was going to go.
What does that mean?
I think Mao had this aura on the American left of having it right about revolution and about the way history was going to unfold. The workers' revolution, workers, peasants, and soldiers, to use the Chinese phrase at the time, you know, that was going to be the next stage in world development.
So it was a confrontational strategy.
Right. On the other hand, you know, I think for many other Americans, both conservative and liberal, you know, saw Mao as the monster, as representing everything evil about China, about totalitarianism. And in some ways, I would argue that both of those views were partially right and partially wrong. That Mao was actually in some ways, a politician of great skill, clearly made significant errors, historic errors, but also was also brilliant in some ways. So I think we need to have a kind of more nuanced view of those leaders. We have this way, I think, of looking at China and Chinese leadership in these very kind of black and white stereotypes.
And yet at this particular time, we have Mao, who's just sort of just coming out of the Cultural Revolution, a time where you're really going to get rid of all vestiges of what he would consider, what they would consider sort of bourgeois, imperialistic, traditional attitudes. And correct me if I'm wrong on that, Crystal. And in the United States, you still had a strong right-wing pressure group, which didn't really want to have anything to do with China. So how were those constituencies bridged in order to make this alliance? And was that a problem, Crystal Zhang? Was it a problem internal to the country to all of a sudden make an alliance with a country that had been seen as sort of the, quote, the devil or the examples of world imperialism and capitalism?
Well, I don't think I have an answer to that question, but based on my understanding and based on my readings in China, it seems like that was a time that basically the leadership trying to figure out where should we go from there after the revolution and after a while, and Chairman Mao was not feeling well physically, he was sick. And then that's the time that I think they're really welcoming U.S. visit from the presidency to see whether how is China going to stand in the world, economically and politically speaking. So that's my take personally.
And William Overholt, how did President Nixon and Secretary Kissinger deal with the fact that there was a sizable group of people within our country that were very much opposed to his initiating contact with China, which was done secretly, and what they thought was giving up Taiwan?
Well, this was a very controversial decision in both countries, and there were large groups both in China and the United States that felt the leadership was selling out. Nixon was in the position where American public opinion was of two minds, quite contradictory. Majority during most of the 70s said we should recognize China. Majority said we should recognize Taiwan. A lesser leader, and I say that in the context of foreign affairs, I think in domestic affairs, Nixon was just almost evil. But in foreign affairs, a lesser leader would have been paralyzed. But Nixon saw a great opportunity in this. He could use this balance of forces and break through and achieve a great progress in dealing with our two biggest problems, which were the Soviet threat and this war we'd gotten bogged down in Vietnam. One important thing about this that's important to recognize is that it was Nixon who made these decisions and told Kissinger what to do. Nixon actually published the idea of a great rapprochement with China in Foreign Affairs magazine before Kissinger was his advisor.
Let me just quick, and we'll go to Howard French in a second. This shows both sides of President Nixon, perhaps, in that 1967 article for Foreign Affairs. He says, taking the long view, we simply cannot afford to leave China forever outside the family of nations, there to nourish its fantasies, cherish its hates, and threaten its neighbors. In a revealing comparison, he said, that dealing with China was like dealing with the angry blacks in America's ghettos. In each case, a potentially destructive force has to be curbed. In each case, an outlaw element has to be brought within law. In each case, dialogues have to be opened. Howard French?
As appalling as that imagery that Nixon has used is to our ears today, a Nixon going to China has become a phrase in our language to say that somebody who has cred with a particular political constituency can do the unexpected sometimes, going against the general principles of that constituency. Nixon was able to do that by operating in secret and presenting a fait accompli, essentially. That's what this diplomacy represented. Max Frankel, the New York Times editor who was on the airplane with Nixon, was not allowed to tell anybody where he was going until all of that was very carefully arranged until the very right moment.
You're listening to Action Speaks. We're talking about the 1972 trip of Richard Nixon to China. We're talking with Howard French, an associate professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, with Crystal Zhang, doctorate and assistant professor of management at Bryan University's Business College. We're talking with Dr. Robert George Lee, an associate professor of American Civilization and the chair of the Department of American Civilization. We're talking with Dr. William H. Overholt, a senior research fellow at the Harvard University's Kennedy School. We're talking about Nixon in China. We're talking about Kissinger. Who gets the credit? Could you please, Jim, play number six?
China does not conduct an aggressive foreign policy. And Chinese history is one of cultural expansion more than of imperial military expansion. And above all, this is a different world. If China and the United States quarrel, and if it becomes a kind of showdown, both countries will suffer enormously and will not achieve anything.
So what began as a handshake, as Nixon gets off the plane, Crystal Zhang, began to cement a relationship which has built over the course of many years. But you reference the fact that China itself has undergone changes. When did the changes towards consumerism or some form of capitalism, or I'm not sure what else to call it, but accumulation of capital perhaps, when did those changes begin to happen and why?
I think it happened since Deng's visit to the South in the 70s, and then when actually there are two forces, internal forces for China's opened up to the world, people start to visit overseas countries, so that happened gradually from 70s to towards 80s nowadays.
But what had to also change? Because was Chairman Mao's philosophy that was carried, at least in this country, in little red books all around, and I'm sure it was available in China, didn't talk about the joys of capitalism and consumerism, I suspect. So something had to begin to change in the philosophy of the government and, by virtue of that, in the people.
I think back to then, in the 70s, people are afraid of talking about making money. Making money is a shame, it's not right, but since 70s, and making money is glorious, and this is how open people's mind to think about, wow, this is amazing, I can make money from importing, exporting, from opening my own businesses, from traveling, from all sorts of businesses. That's how people start to open their mind.
Bob?
I think we run the risk of parsing this too finely. You know, the period of the Cultural Revolution is a relatively short period. And it's a period so that you have, you know, in the 1950s and the 1960s, several changes in economic policy, some of which shift towards more market economies, sometimes less, different levels of production. The Chinese have argued against, for example, complete reliance on heavy industry, increasing what they call intermediate industries, and so more consumable goods in China than in the Soviet Union in comparable periods, for example. So I think it's hard to just simply say, oh, there's this Maoist period that's all the same between 1949 and 1975. And clearly the reforms do make this big shift, but it's not as if that everything from 1949 up until 1975 is somehow some sort of gray, monotonous policy.
William Overhaupt, but I want to just read a quote here from Deng Xiaoping. Domestic reform and opening to the outside world should be a long-term national policy, and the development of Sino-U.S. relations was inherently necessary to these policies. The purpose of establishing diplomatic relationships with the United States was to create an international environment favorable to domestic construction, reform, and opening up. Bill Overhaupt.
I agree with what Bob said about the ups and downs, but if you want to understand the transition in China, you have to look at the number of groups Mao damaged in the Cultural Revolution, which was 1966 to 1976. He launched a revolutionary movement against the government bureaucracy, against the Communist Party. The leaders of China found themselves paraded with dunce caps on their heads. The president, Liu Shaoqi, jailed and died years later of diseases, caught in jail. The army was severely damaged. The managers of of enterprises, the workers, the farmers, went through the most unbelievable suffering. And by the time this was over and Mao died, virtually the entire population was ready for a change. Mao had been able to hold on through inertia, and this guy Hua Guofeng with his two whatevers for a while. But Deng Xiaoping was a figure who had stood up to Mao. His kid had been tossed out of the upper story of a building and permanently crippled. He's been in a wheelchair ever since. And he was saying, look at what the people in South Korea are accomplishing. Look at what Taiwan is accomplishing. Everybody is doing better than we are. That's what we should do. Mao's legacy for that period, I think, was of two kinds. One was the pragmatism, deal with the United States even though we were the ideological enemy. The second is commitment to focus on economic development and not to waste the nation's resources in overseas adventures. Even under Mao, they would not intervene in Vietnam. They tried that in Korea, and they didn't like the They didn't like what happened.
Question from the audience. Can you give your name and where you're from?
Yeah, hi, my name is John, and I'm from Johnston. As you know, the British fought a war to import opium into China, and half the population was addicted. Every vice imaginable was available in China. I mean, the women's feet were bound, child brides. Incredible backwardness till the Communist Party of China took power in 49. How were they able to eradicate drug addiction, prostitution, this child brides? How were they able to liberate half the women, as Mao said, women hold up half the sky? In a country so backward, so incredibly backward, decimated by the imperial powers, Japanese, British, American, that America can't eradicate drug addiction, can't eradicate prostitution and venereal disease.
Let's talk. Take an answer from the audience. Crystal Zhang, how were they able to accomplish all that?
My take is that that's the benefits that we have been ignoring is about the centralized government. If you look at Chinese government reaction to SARS and to H1N1 flu, it is immediate. It is very actually really is proactive, and they are able to control the outbreak of the flu, of the SARS, in the short period of time, like within 3 days. They're able to build something. They're able to have centralized policy, which pass through from the state to the municipal to the rural areas. This is one of the benefits of being a centralized government.
Bob Lee, and Howard French.
You know, I think in some ways there's an interesting analogy. One of the things that we've been talking about is after the Cultural Revolution, people are ready for a change. Well, I would argue that in the 1940s, Chinese people were ready for a change. And so that when the revolution, when the Chinese Communist Party comes to power, people are ready to be mobilized. And you see this mobilization going on in village after village after village. Now, granted, it often takes extraordinarily violent, you know, manifestations. It has to do also with the overthrowing of feudal classes, so to speak, to use the Chinese terms. But it's another form of modernization. If we might think of the 1980s as a moment of modernization, well, certainly there's a moment of modernization in 1949. As well.
Are you listening to Action Speaks? Today we're talking about President Nixon's 1972 trip to China and the results in this interdependency that's continued to this day between the Chinese economy and the United States economy. We're with Howard French, an associate professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, Crystal Zhang, an assistant professor of management at Bryan University's Business College, Robert George Lee, an associate professor of American Civilization and chair of the Department of American Civilization at Brown University, and William Overholt, a senior research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. And we have a question from the audience. Could you tell us where you're from?
Yeah, Bert from Providence. And Crystal, you maybe have started to answer this question. I mean, for better or worse, Mao professed an ideology. Mao professed a set of values. And what is the ideology and what is the set of values that is driving the decision-making in China today?
Crystal?
I think back then, it's I don't know, it's total different ideology, I would say. But although I see this as not a divergence from Mao's value. I see Deng Xiaoping have something modernized than the Mao's value. I think they're heading to the same direction, they're building to a healthy, harmonious society. Although Mao probably have more control in how the country is developing, well, Deng's vision is we will have different ways as long as we are moving towards the big direction altogether. So that's my take.